Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the second class in the Discovering Buddhism module, Samsara and Nirvana. See, do we have anyone who is here tonight who wasn't here last week? A lot of people. Well, you'll never catch up with the rest of us. I don't think it should be any problem. Just want to make sure everyone knows this module is only 4 weeks, so there are only two more classes after tonight. It's not a six-week module. It's a four-week module. And the topic is Samsara and Nirvana. And as the basis for that discussion, we'll be using the 12 links of dependent origination, which we see in this visual aid that I'll be discussing more later this evening. Let's see, do we have anyone who's here for the very first time at Kadampa Center tonight? Okay. Let's begin with some meditation. Begin by checking your posture. The point of the posture is not to be uncomfortable or painful or distracting. The point is to establish a posture that is stable and that can maintain itself as we do the meditation that follows. And the basics of the posture are based on opening up the energy channels, which flow through the body, from the head, down in front of the spine, down to the areas of the genitals. It's not something that you can find if you dissect the body, but it's the path which the energy on which our consciousness is said to ride flows along these channels. So the first way to open up those channels is to have a nice straight back, not rigid or stiff, but a little straighter than you normally sit. Your head is maybe just a couple degrees in front of the vertical, but certainly not, your chin is not down on your chest, and your head's not tilted to one side or the other. Eyes are either just slightly open or lightly closed. Mouth is lightly closed, the jaw is not clenched. The tongue is against the upper palate, above the teeth. Shoulders are relaxed and down. A little bit back, so our chest is open. Again, to open the energy channels. Upper arms away from the torso. Right hand on left. Thumbs touching. That represents the union of wisdom and compassion. That describes enlightenment. And legs, if we're sitting on a cushion, crossed in a position that we find comfortable. If we sit towards the front of the cushion, that's a little bit easier to do. If we're sitting in a chair, our feet are flat on the floor or flat on a cushion if we need that to support our feet. So scan the posture. If there's any sort of tension or discomfort right now, address them now so that you don't need to deal with them during the meditation. And we'll begin with a very simple version of the 9-round breathing which just helps settle the mind. There are very many ways of doing this. This is one of the simplest. And we'll take our middle finger, close our left nostril, take three deep breaths in and out through the right nostril. Then we'll close our right nostril, three deep breaths in and out through the left nostril, and then three deep breaths in and out through both nostrils. And the stomach expands on the in-breath. So our diaphragm is pulled down, our lungs completely filled, and as we exhale, the stomach comes back towards the spine. Okay. Three in and out through the right nostril. And now we allow our breathing to return to its normal pattern. And we take a moment to set our motivation. We're doing the meditation to follow. And any motivation is a valid one. If we just want a little bit of peace and quiet, great. If we want to develop a little bit of equanimity or calmness of mind, that's great. But I've said the most powerful motivation is the motivation of bodhicitta, the continuous thought that I am doing everything so I can be of greater benefit to others. Even something as simple as coming to Kadampa Center, doing this meditation, and participating in the discussion to follow is to make a positive imprint on my mind stream, so that it can be of greater benefit to others. So even if it doesn't seem natural, just take a moment and generate, even if it's effortfully, that motivation. And having set our motivation, we now begin the actual meditation, just watching the breath, the mind observing the breath, the physical sensation of breath moving in and out through the nostrils. Nothing more, nothing less than that. Not counting the breath, not describing the breath, not thinking about the breath, but direct perception. So that we can almost say, in a way, that mind and breath are the same. There is no duality. The mind is what it perceives. And whenever we notice that the mind is perceiving something else, an itch, or an ache, or a memory of something that happened today, or a plan on something we have to do tomorrow, we just set that aside and come back to the breath. Mind perceives breath. And we can end our meditation by doing a brief dedication. We acknowledge that we've done something a little bit unusual. We've put some effort into training our mind, developing a little bit of concentration by paying attention to the breath, and in the very subtlest way, our mind now is not the same mind that it was before the meditation. Just to some degree, we've developed this positive quality. And we can acknowledge that and rejoice in that and dedicate all the good things that come from that quality of concentration to the benefit of all living beings, including ourselves. Any questions or comments about that meditation? You needed it, okay? Well, you can take it home with you and do it there too, okay? Okay. Okay, so we've already jumped into the subject of the course, samsara and nirvana. We'll review a little bit of the material we talked about last week. What is samsara? Can somebody give me a definition? Cyclic existence. And what does cyclic existence mean? Yeah. Being reborn over and over again, going through the cycle of birth, old age, sickness, and death, birth, old age, sickness, and death without any choice. Being to some degree, we could almost say, even though we don't like to talk about being a victim, we are a victim of our karma, or our karma is controlling that cycle, the cycle of samsara. And it is characterized primarily by what kind of experience, if we're willing to be honest with ourselves. Suffering. Okay, a lot of people don't like to hear that, don't like to admit it. You can substitute the word unsatisfactoriness for suffering. Disappointment. Unrealizations. But the standard term that's used is suffering. That cyclic existence is characterized primarily by suffering. And the Buddha said there are three types of suffering. And that we experience in samsara. And does anybody know what those are? The suffering of suffering, the suffering of succotash, or the suffering succotash, suffering of suffering, okay?
Suffering of change.
Suffering
of change.
Persistent suffering. Wrong P word. Close. Suffering of pervasiveness, okay? Yeah. Persistent is good. Persistent is a good word for it, too. Okay, suffering of suffering. Somebody want to define what the suffering of suffering is?
Physical
suffering, pain, illness, emotional loss, disappointment. It's the kind of suffering we can identify quite easily. Okay, suffering of suffering is physical, mental, emotional pain. And it's suffering, okay? What's the suffering of change?
More or less impermanence.
Impermanence to some degree, okay. What do you mean by impermanence?
Not permanent.
They're not permanent. Okay, pleasurable experiences are not permanent. Okay, and as we see them fading away, we start to cling to them and grasp to them, and we realize that just repeating a pleasurable experience over and over is not happiness. Yeah, yeah. But even pleasurable experiences, if prolonged over time, are not happy. They offer temporary pleasure, but they don't offer permanent happiness. And certainly, you know, we can have the example of eating a delicious food. One bite is good. 3 bites is pretty good. 10 bites, we're getting sated, but it's on the plate, so we go ahead and take 5 more bites. And it actually, if we're willing to look at it, it has become unpleasant. In the same way, we can have a pleasant thought or emotion. Oh, you say, oh, that's nice to think about. But what if you had to think about nothing but that for 10 hours straight? That thought would no longer be pleasurable. It would be torture. So the point is that there is nothing inherently in those experiences, either physical or mental, that is the cause of happiness. Okay? They are at some level unsatisfactory. The third type of suffering, suffering of pervasiveness. Anybody want to take a stab at that? This is the hardest one to see, the hardest one to define, the hardest one to get a sense of. But what the Buddha is saying here, that in samsara, our karma forces us to have a mind and a body that experience the first two types of suffering. That it's almost like we are suffering magnets or suffering receptors. That there is something in the nature of this body and mind that samsara forces on us that causes us to experience the other two types of suffering. Okay? We're suffering magnets as long as we are in samsara. Okay. So is everybody depressed? Buddhism is such a gloomy religion, right? It is if you stop there, okay? But the Buddha says there is an end to suffering, the second noble truth. The first noble truth being the truth of suffering, the second being the end of suffering. And what is that called? Now, what's another word for the end of suffering? The end of personal suffering? No. What's the name of this class? Nirvana. Okay? Nirvana is the end of personal suffering. Okay? It means you are no longer in samsara. You have eliminated whatever it is that is holding you in samsara. You are out of this endless cycle. Okay? You are free of suffering. So what's the main way that we get out of, and we'll talk about this in more detail, how do we get out of samsara and into nirvana, which are not places. It's not like we buy a plane ticket. Say, I'd like a one-way ticket from samsara to nirvana, first class, please. This is a mental process. How do we get out of samsara and into nirvana? That's one way, but in this tradition, we tend to talk about another. Sometimes he mentioned the Eightfold Path. That's frequently used, particularly in the Hinayana tradition, but in the Mahayana tradition, we talk about renunciation is the wish to get out of it, okay, is the what motivates us to get on the plane that takes us from samsara nirvana. What's the jet fuel for it, or what's the actual push? No, not enlightenment. One part of enlightenment. Yeah. We eliminate ignorance from our mind stream, okay? Ignorance is what keeps us in samsara. If we eliminate ignorance from our mind stream, we are free from samsara, we are free from personal suffering. We are free from the forced cycle of birth, old age, sickness, and death, if we eliminate ignorance. And what do we mean by ignorance? Does it mean that we haven't read the 100 books and we don't have a PhD? How do we define ignorance? Yeah, not seeing reality as it is. Not seeing how objects, experiences, other people, but not seeing in particular how I exist. We're deluded, mistaken about the nature of reality. So seeing reality directly, without any projections, without any misperceptions, without any hallucinations, is wisdom in the Buddhist point of view. Okay? Ignorance is not an inherent part of our mind. It's like the clouds in the sky, our mind being the empty sky, the clouds being ignorance. They can be removed. Okay? We remove ignorance, we're no longer in samsara. We're in a state called nirvana, freedom from personal suffering. What's a person who hangs out in nirvana called? An arhat, okay? Someone who sees reality as it is, an arhat. Now, to become a Buddha, to achieve an complete enlightenment, we have to develop compassion, okay? And if an arhat chooses to be born, get old, sick, and die, he's doing that out of compassion for others, so that he can stay in the world and teach others. That's what the Buddha did, okay? He manifested as he was a Buddha, but he appeared as an ordinary human being with a mind and a body like ours, but he was not suffering, or he had attained those, okay? He had a mind and a body, but they're not suffering. We refer to this union of mind and body in samsara as the aggregates. They're technically five of them. I don't think we need to go into that. But it refers to the temporary coming together of our body and mind for one lifetime. At the time of death, the mind and body separate. According to the Buddhist philosophy, the body decays, breaks down into its component parts. The mind continues on. Consciousness, in the Buddhist point of view, is without beginning, without end. So we've all had countless rebirths and we'll have countless rebirths in the future. And that's what the 12 links are about. So one model the Buddha gave us to really understand why we're in samsara and what we have to do to get out of it is referred to as the 12 links of dependent origination. It's a very, very key teaching in Buddha. And it said if you study just that and really understand it, you can get out of samsara if you understand the 12 links. Okay? Yeah, question?
Is an arhat more or less used in the Theravada tradition?
Is an arhat, is it in the Theravada tradition? Yes, and some of the Theravada traditions feel that that is the ultimate goal. They even deny the possibility of going beyond that to complete enlightenment. The Mahayana tradition, which Tibetan is a part of, says you can become an arhat, but then compassion moves you to go on to become a Buddha. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Yeah, Susie.
In some of the purification processes, in past lives, I've gotten this far on the path, you know, maybe I've done tantric practices.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's possible that you have done high level practices but have not achieved nirvana and then you go back.
You backslide, yeah. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily, I mean, you could go to square negative 10, yeah. Or you could go down to 9. Yeah, I mean, you know, we're all up and down like this based on the karma we're creating. My understanding is, though, once you become an arhat, you cannot backslide below that level. Okay? You stay an arhat, okay? You may not have the compassion aspect, okay? You may be a very unnice arhat, but you're still an arhat. You're not having any personal suffering.
But if you choose to come back. You can be in arhat and choose to come back to develop.
In fact, you want to eventually. Yeah. I mean, you, according to the Mahayana point of view, and this is something way beyond, you know, where most of ours, being an arhat, seeing reality directly, is incredibly blissful. It's like nonstop sequential orgasms, they say, you know, just firing on all cylinders continuously. So, yeah, so there is a danger of just staying in that state, of just staying there and blissing out. But at some point, you realize that others are suffering in the same way that you did, from the exact same cause, ignorance, and you want to do what you can to help them. Okay, so that's when you start working on developing your own compassion as an arhat. Okay? Yeah. And what can a Buddha do for others? Or what can an arhat do? How can they help others? Can they take away their suffering? Can the Buddha take away someone else's suffering? What can a Buddha do? He can teach. That's it.
Can you explain?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He can show people what he's learned.
And a bodhisattva.
An arhat and a bodhisattva. Yeah, they're the two. The arhat, the smart. He's completely developed the wisdom aspect. The bodhisattva is the nice guy. He's completely developed the compassion aspect. A Buddha has developed both. He's smart and nice at the same time. All the time. Okay?
Be a
stupid bodhisattva or a mean arhat. You know, if you want to simplify it, yeah. You'll be a really dumb bodhisattva, yeah.
Okay,
yeah, you haven't. A bodhisattva has not achieved nirvana, yeah. I'm not sure about that one. They talk less about it. Generally, it's assumed that for most people, you become an arhat before you become a bodhisattva, though everybody's path is different. But you tend to work on eliminating personal suffering first, because that makes it easier for you to think about helping others. Okay, not because you're selfish, but it makes it, you can't help others if you're, you know, all screwed up. So the general way the path is presented, you work on eliminating personal suffering first, the wisdom aspect, then you work on the compassion aspect and become a bodhisattva. And then when you become a bodhisattva, it says you still have certain very subtle negative karma that you have to remove before you become a Buddha. Because a Buddha is outside the force of karma. Everything the Buddha does is completely free choice. A Buddha is no longer controlled by karmic imprints created in the past.
They have some
subtle karma, yeah. They're not in samsara, but they do have karmic imprints or blocks to becoming enlightened or to becoming a bodhisattva that they have to remove. Okay, so big structure. So we study the 12 links so we can understand why we're in samsara. If we follow the circle clockwise, that tells us why we're in samsara, what's keeping us in here, what force. If we follow it reverse clockwise, that tells us how to get out, what we have to eliminate. Okay? So we'll go through that. We'll start going through it clockwise tonight. And this is the traditional Tibetan depiction of the wheel of life with a few other things thrown in. If you're towards the back and can't see this well, you may want to move up to the front a little bit. Very typical Tibetan colors and graphic design, very elaborate as you can see. The whole thing is referred to as the wheel of life. These are the 12 links here, but we'll talk about that more. This is typically placed right outside the door of a meditation room so that you can look at it before you go in. Makes a very strong imprint on your mind stream. Samsara, I want to get out. Gives some force to your meditation practice, which is why it's so prominently displayed. His Holiness the Dalai Lama has several of these that he always sets up in his hotel room when he's at Motel 6 or wherever he stays, while he's traveling around the world teaching. Okay. So So, this big red dude here, anybody know who that is? That's, he's referred to as Yama. And who is Yama? Yeah, the Lord of Death, okay? Just a big reminder that death is inevitable, okay? A symbolic representation that death is going to come to all of us. And he holds within his arms and legs the wheel of life, but life is controlled by death. He's got two arms, two feet, and they say that this one is birth, old age, sickness, death. Birth, old age, sickness, and death. So those four things grasp the wheel of life. And those were what Shakyamuni Buddha thought the palace had, so the education and life. You know, he didn't see anything unpleasant until he snuck out and he saw an old person, a sick person, and a dead person. Okay, birth, old age, and death. And then we have, and you notice he's got skulls on his head. He's got five skulls there. Why do we have skulls there? Anybody want to take a guess at that? Yeah. No, not the, maybe they are because they're five, but yeah, the right answer is here. Impermanence, okay? What does impermanence mean in Buddhist? What does it mean? What's the specific definition of impermanence? It's good to be clear on this. It means that everything is changing, okay? It doesn't mean that things necessarily come to an end, but it means everything is continually changing. Because something like consciousness does not come to an end, but consciousness is still referred to as impermanent because it's always changing. And so our bodies are always changing. At some point, rather than a head with skin on it, we'll just have a skull. So that's why you see lots of skulls in Tibetan iconography, and sometimes people will even have a little skull on their mala or something. It's to remind you of the inevitability of death and the truth of impermanence. That's all. It's nothing weirder than that. So we've got this wheel, and in the center, in the hub that's turning the whole wheel of life, we have a pig, and out of the pig's mouth is coming a snake, and the snake is biting the tail of a chicken, and the chicken has got hold of the tail of the pig. Sometimes the snake and the chicken are depicted as both coming out of the mouth of the pig. Anybody know what those?
Three poisons.
Three poisons, yeah, three poisonous minds. And what are they?
Hatred.
Yeah, which one's which?
Pig is ignorance.
The pig is ignorance. Snake is anger or hatred.
Chicken
is attachment. Okay. So sometimes they're depicted with the snake and the chicken coming out of the mouth of the pig because ignorance is really the root of the other two, the source of the other two. Ignorance, again, being not seeing reality. They use a pig because the Tibetans thought a pig would lie down in just any kind of filth and not care. Okay, was not aware of its environment. The snake is anger because it tends to strike out. The chicken is attachment because it's always going around picking at things, grabbing things. Okay? So those are the hub that turns the wheel of life. Then on the right-hand side, with some very nice-looking people, and they're in this very pleasant environment, and they're looks like they're climbing up this hill, and there's an actual Buddha up there. Okay, so these people are going up. It's nice and happy and everything. And this side's very dark, and you have people without clothes falling down and look like they're in a lot of pain. This represents people moving on to a favorable rebirth. Okay, consciousness is moving to a favorable rebirth. Up the scale, these represent consciousness is going down into a less favorable rebirth. Okay, so according to the Buddhist philosophy, there's six possible realms in which we can be reborn. The three upper realms are let's see, humans here, human realm here, demigod realm here, and then the god realm here. Okay? Human realm, we're familiar with it. It's having a human body and mind. God realm, you can see they're lying on cushions, and it's beautiful, and they're nice flowers. It's a beautiful garden. The human realm, they're kind of laboring. They're working, but they're not unhappy. God realm, just completely blissful. Here they are in a swimming pool. Looks like they're skinny dipping over there. Yeah, you know, just also they're blissed out here. And then we have here the demigod realm, which is nice, but they've got these spears and stuff, and they're kind of trying to grab stuff from the god realm, okay? The god realm is characterized by great pleasure. Okay, it's like taking a wonderful trip to Santa Barbara or Paris or someplace like that, going on a great vacation. Okay, the demigod realm is taking a trip and not going to such a nice place, and characterized to a little degree, some degree, by envy of what's going on in the god realm. Okay? But they still have a nice body, nice environment. They're obviously intelligent, but it's not quite as good as in the god realm. So these are considered the three more favorable rebirths. Why are they considered favorable rebirths? Well, you have the potential in all six possible rebirths. These are considered favorable because it is the conditions are easier to work to develop your mind to become enlightened, okay? The human realm is actually said to be the most favorable because it has the perfect combination of enough good things but just enough suffering to motivate us, okay? In the God realm, you know, you can sit there and just be blissed out, but you're not motivated. You're not aware of your suffering until right before you die. And it said that when you die, it's just terrifying because they're losing everything and they haven't prepared for it. Okay, but still the potential to be, to develop your mind. Demigod realm, you can develop your mind, but you're being envious a lot of times. So that kind of limits your practice. So those are the three favorable rebirths, the ones we would like to obtain. So these are the people going up. The three unfavorable rebirths are the animal realm here. And really, it looks pretty pleasant the way they're depicted here. They're not eating each other or being butchered or anything, but this is the animal realm. And these are the hell realms. And these are the hungry ghost realm, okay? Animal realms, even though you don't see it here, are characterized by need or by just fighting to survive. And we're not talking about a pampered house pet. We're talking about animals who live in the wild, whose main goal is to fight and not be killed. You can still become enlightened if you're a cockroach, but it's much more difficult to make any kind of spiritual progress in that realm because you're obsessed with the ideas of eating and not being killed. Okay? The hell realms are characterized by continuous pain. Okay? So again, very hard to work on your mind in that environment. And the hungry ghost realm are characterized by not having enough of anything. Food, water, clothing, shelter. And they're depicted as having big bellies. Obviously, they knew about kwashiorkor and always grasping. So these are considered less favorable rebirths, ones we don't want, because it's harder to have to make spiritual progress in those realms. Not impossible, but harder, okay? With the animal realm being the best of those three, the hungry ghost the next, and the hell realms being the most difficult to think about any kind of, you know, if you're there, you know, being experiencing incredible pain, how can you think about developing compassion or concentration or any of these qualities? It's possible, but just very, very difficult. So these people are having less favorable rebirths, or these consciousnesses are having less favorable rebirths going to the lower or less favorable realms. Now, whether the These are mental places. They're also physical places. They exist. The Buddha said, I mean, I can't vouch for this, but these are that are created by your karma. In the same way, we live in a nice environment in Raleigh, North Carolina, with a Buddhist center, not because of luck or not just because of randomness, but because of our karma, our past actions of body, speech, and mind. In the same way, if our consciousness is reborn with a body, come in one of these realms, that's the result of karma. Okay? Yeah.
You can have a human body, but your consciousness is one of those.
Well, that's a good way to get in touch with us. The Buddha said that, you really don't experience the hell realm till you're reborn in the hell realm. Okay, we have hints of it in the human realm, but it's a completely different experience. And again, it's not a place that we can go to on a plane or anything, but it is the result of our mind in the same way that this environment is the result of our mind and our karma. Yeah. Right.
So well, and you jump over like the demigod from that you've almost built up that positive.
I think you would want to be reborn in the human realm as much as possible. And then they say you would want to be reborn and have the good karma to become a monk or a nun in the human realm. That would be even better karma, according to the teachings. The Buddha achieved enlightenment in the human realm.
Okay.
I don't think we're at the point where we can choose, okay? The point is just to create as much good karma as possible. I can't answer that question. Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but I can't answer it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Susie.
There's something about it's hard to become enlightened when you're conscious.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I never thought of the possibility of becoming enlightened from one of the desirable realms. I mean, I thought you had to. Sometimes I wondered, you have to go through the entire long realm.
I'm just saying it is not, there is no reason why a cockroach could not become enlightened. Incredibly, 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 incredibly difficult. But according to the teachings, it's possible.
You don't have to, know every teaching.
Well, we've all been in all these realms countless times.
Right.
Okay? If a cockroach just by some karmic imprint, and we'll talk about karma, has the karmic imprint, burning up some last bit of negative karma, and then it goes from cockroach to enlightenment. Okay? It may just be, the cockroach doesn't live very long. You may have been in the human realm, and then you just have to go down to the cockroach realm to just get rid of some little karma, and then on to it. Yeah, that's the old joke, you're sitting there and getting bit by, yeah, you sit there in the summer and getting bit by a mosquito and go, on to enlightenment. No, don't try that. They're not good, yeah. It would be incredibly difficult. The cockroach would have to have an incredible amount of merit created from previous lifetimes that's not lost from its consciousness. And remember that when, say, you went from a human realm to the cockroach realm, it's not going to be Susie with her personality and mind in that cockroach's body. It's going to be a cockroach mind and a cockroach body. It's still carrying all the karmic imprints, but it's not like Susie's inside of a cockroach, with everything she's learned.
The cockroach can't study.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if it goes to enlightenment from there, it would have to be the result of a lot of positive karma that was on its consciousness already. Yeah. But the main thing is, okay, you're carrying with you what you have from other realms, but you're not adding to it. You're probably creating some juice. Okay. Doing okay now? Thank you. Okay, any other questions about what I've covered so far? Okay, then we go to the outer circle, the 12 links. And I'll just start up here and give you the names, and then we'll start going through them, and then we'll finish going through them tomorrow night. Typically, when you're thinking, even though it's a continuous chain, you start thinking about them up here, and this is ignorance. Okay, and it shows a blind person. In this depiction, he's walking around, he's feeling where he's going. Ignorance, or sometimes referred to as unawareness. The next one shows some potters making pots, not Susan and Richard Potter, but other potters. And that is karma or formative action. Okay, but you can just think of that one as karma. The third one is a monkey sitting in a tree, and that is consciousness. Okay, the fourth one is the man in a boat on a sea with icebergs, and that is name and form. Fifth one is a group of buildings on a hill with windows, and that is contact, or you can just think of a building with windows. Contact. Wait a minute, no, that's six sources. Six sources, okay? Sources. The buildings with windows is sources. The sixth one is a man and woman making love, and that is contact. Seventh one is a man with a stick in his eye, and that is feeling. Let's see. The next one is some men, and I think they're drinking here, and that is craving. Nine is men pulling some fruit off a tree, that is grasping. Or as Geshe Gelug says, grasping. Tenth is a woman with a baby, that's becoming. Mm-hmm. Nine is grasping. Let me go through them all, and then if you've missed one, I'll go back and do them again, okay? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Craving. Craving and grasping. Okay. That is becoming. 11th is a woman becoming, giving birth, and that is birth. And 12 is some old people, and that's aging and death. Okay? Ignorance. Karma or formative action. Consciousness. Name and form. Sources. Six sources. Contact. Feeling. Craving, grasping, becoming, birth, aging, and death. It gets a little bit complicated in that this describes events that are happening over several lifetimes. And not necessarily consecutive lifetimes. And this cycle is going on multiple times. Okay? And we'll talk more about this. We try and make it very linear and sequential. They are all linked, but it's not like we start here, go around here, and that's this lifetime. that's the next lifetime. Okay, we have multiples of these cycles going on at any one time. And we're going into different lifetimes here, and that should become clearer as we discuss this tonight. And so just drop the idea that this describes one lifetime of being born, dying, and reborn. Okay, it doesn't. It's not that easy. It's not that clear. Okay? So we'll start with just the first couple links tonight. Any questions so far? But remember, this is a wheel. It's the hub of ignorance, anger, and attachment that is turning everything. That's turning the people moving up, people moving down. The six realms, the 12 links, all being turned with ignorance really at the hub. Ignorance is turning this wheel, keeping it in motion continually within the bounds of life and death. Yeah. I don't know, yeah. I'm not going to explain them as relating, okay? I don't know if there's any relation. Yeah. And then up here we have a Buddha in a pure land, a Buddha who's attained enlightenment. Up here sometimes there's a moon here, but here they actually have a Buddha or a Bodhisattva. And then over here we have another Buddha or Bodhisattva with an arm is out. It means he's showing us the path, how to get here. Okay, indicating the way. And then I'm sure there's a lot more iconography that I cannot explain. But it's a general structure of a wheel of life that you'll see outside every official Tibetan meditation room. But the 12 links is a teaching that's found in almost all the Buddhist traditions. But this is the way the Tibetans display it typically. Any other questions or comments? Am I going back over there? No, I think I'll stay right here. But yeah, yeah, okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, if you want to move back to your place, yeah, I'm not going to refer to that anymore. Okay, so for this discussion, we'll start with ignorance. Okay, here's the textbook definition of ignorance. Ignorance is the wrong view of the perishing aggregates, which newly motivates its second branch, formative action or karma. By it's referring to the 12 links. So that sounds pretty obscure. Yeah. Ignorance is the wrong view of the perishing aggregates, which newly motivates its second branch, and by it's referring to the 12 links, formative action or karma. Okay. So when we talk about ignorance, there are two major things we're ignorant of. What are they? We mentioned one earlier. Reality. Okay, we don't see things the way they are. What's the other thing that we're generally ignorant of? That's in the first one, yeah, we'll talk about. Second one is the laws of karma, the rules of karma. Okay? We don't understand karma and how it works. In the 12 links, we're dealing primarily with the first type, not seeing reality as it is. And in particular, our ignorance about ourself, about how we exist. So they're saying ignorance is the wrong view of the perishing aggregates. By the aggregates, we mean body and mind coming together that functions conventionally in the world as Robbie. We know they're going to perish. Robbie's body will dissolve, and Robbie's mind, though the consciousness continues, a lot of the mind goes away when I die. Also, my personality, okay, that doesn't go on to the next life. And the body and the mind separate. So ignorance is the wrong view of the perishing aggregates, which newly motivates, okay, causes the next link, formative action or karma. So what they're saying is that our wrong view of the self is what causes karma. We create karma, which means actions. Okay, we act because of our wrong view of self. That's the primary cause of creating karma. The Buddha has a correct view of self, or you can even say an arhat has a correct view of self and does not create negative karma, does not create karma. Well, hold on. I'll say a Buddha does not create karma. I'm not sure about an arhat, but a Buddha, is everything is completely free choice. Completely. With us, it's about 99% karma and a little dab of free choice. As we make progress along our spiritual path, the free choice becomes greater and the force of karma becomes less. Okay? So what is our wrong view of self that creates all this karma? How would you describe it as a wrong view? Or what's wrong about it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we believe we're self-existent, that we just exist, that there are no causes or conditions that brought us into existence. What else is wrong about the way we see ourselves? See, it is independent, which is kind of the reverse. We don't see that we are interdependent. We have this dichotomy. We think we are independent. We think that I am this Robbie who is walking through life and having these experiences, but there is some independent, unchangeable Robbie that these experiences are happening to. And the Buddha says, no, there's really just the experiences. There's no Robbie that has those experiences. There's a body that has physical sensations. There is a mind that has thoughts and memories and emotions, but that's all there is. There's no Robbie behind them that the body and mind belong to. Okay? It is just a series of moments of that body and that mind, both of which are continually changing, which we put the label Robbie on. Okay? We don't see that. We think there is an inherently existent, independent, to some degree, unchanging Robbie that is the owner of the body and mind. We project a Robbie out there, or I project a Robbie out there, or I project a Robbie that does not exist at all. That is a complete delusion of that Robbie that the body and mind belong to. There's just the convention of that body and mind being labeled as Robbie as they function in the world. But that other Robbie, the one that has the experiences that the body belongs to, that the mind belongs to, is a delusion, does not exist. And it's very hard to see this when we first come to Buddhism. It said that sometimes if we've said a really good place to see the false Robbie, the Robbie that doesn't really exist, is when we've been falsely accused of something. When we're accused of doing something that we didn't do. And there's a sense of, ugh, I, that arises. Don't tell me that. Don't talk to me that way. That's a very strong sense of a very strong belief in this non-existent I. Also said when we're in physical danger, we can identify that I am going to be hurt. I am going to die. I am going to suffer. Okay? But it's that ignorance of not seeing how Robbie really exists that causes us to act out of anger and attachment. Because we think there is this I exist, that needs to be protected, that needs to harm anyone who's going to threaten it, that needs to be fed, that needs to get the things it wants. It has to be pampered and protected. And that's where anger and attachment come from. Out of an identification of clinging to a believing in that I that does not exist. And that's ignorance. Questions, comments? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's still okay to defend yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you have, I mean, ideally, if it were appropriate, if it were the compassionate thing to do, it's done out of wisdom, but you would realize you were just defending a temporary coming together of the aggregates of body and mind. There is no inherently existing Susie that you are defending, because you have this clinging, cherishing to a Susie that doesn't even exist. Okay? Certainly, if you think it's a compassionate thing, so that you'll be able to help others to defend your body and mind, fine, yeah, if you can do it without anger.
Or so that your mother doesn't...
That would be compassionate, yeah, mm-hmm, yeah, mm-hmm. But there's certainly, you know, even in that, you know, that's a compassion, but there's a certain amount of clinging there to my mother. I don't want my mother to suffer. So what we're moving towards is a sense of it being much less personal than we make everything. There are experiences going on. There's a body having thoughts. A mind having thoughts, yeah. A body experiencing physical sensations. But it's not so personal. And there's a book, I think, by Daniel Kohan called Thoughts Without a Thinker. The thoughts are there, but there's not a thinker that they belong to. It's just a series of thoughts. You know, if we took... You know, if we say we took this line up here and looked at it under a super high microscope, what would we see? We think that we see a line there, but if we looked at it more closely, what would we see? We'd see a series of discontinued dots with space in between them. We would not see a line, okay? And in the same way, if we look at our experience very closely, we'll see experiences of body, experiences of mind. When we look at the big picture, we can label that conventional Robbie. But there is, if we look at it closely, we can't find Robbie in there. We just find a series of moments. Okay, one after another after another. Connected, you know, influencing each other, one leading to the next, but there's no unbroken line that we could identify there. Okay? So in the same way that we can say, even though we see this line, we know if we look at it under a microscope, there is no line there, right? Okay? When we look at it more closely, there is no line there. So in the same way that Susie exists conventionally in the world, if we look more closely, more truthfully, we'll see there is no Susie in that sense. There is a body and mind. Okay? But there is no Susie that the body and mind belong to. Okay? So that's the type of ignorance that we have to eliminate here. We have to eliminate the thought that sees a self that does not exist, that sees it and believes in it, that thinks that's true. That's the killer. Not just that we see it, but we think that is true. We're believing in something that not only is wrong, but doesn't even exist. Okay? A complete hallucination. It's not like we're having a dream and we know it's a dream. It's like we're having an acid trip and we believe that is reality that we're seeing. Okay? We believe in it. And that's what causes negative actions. Okay? That's where the karma of attachment and hatred arise from wanting to protect, preserve, hold on to that I that doesn't even exist. So it's really sad when you think about it, and for ourselves and for other people, because we're all in samsara together. We all have the same fundamental ignorance. In all six realms, everyone in all those realms has that misapprehension of self. Okay? All those realms are all in samsara, okay? They are all in the nature of suffering that is forced on you by your karma, okay? The goal is to get out of them completely, not to get to the God realm and stay there. So even in the God realm, they have the same fundamental misconception of self. Yeah, question?
Could the same misunderstanding of reality create good karma? Like, even if it was a perfection of reality, you would have compassion towards another person because of that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it'll be mixed, okay? It won't be completely good if it has a fundamental quality of ignorance, but that's where we are. And we are creating good karma even though we haven't seen reality directly. So compassion, even when it's mixed with ignorance, does create positive karma. Okay, not purely positive, but it does create good karma. Yeah. Did you have a question? Is it safe to say that you are what you're thinking? I think you are what you're thinking plus your karma. Okay, you have those karmic imprints on your mind stream. So to say what is in your mind right now is not the sum total of who you are. Okay, because you still have those karmic imprints, even if you're not aware of them. But you're going in the right direction. You've gone a little bit too far, okay? But it's like when we do the breathing meditation, our mind, if we keep it on our breath, the mind is the breath. There is no, just because one's physical and one is mental, the mind is mental, the breath is, they are in the same nature. Neither of them has any inherent existence, okay? But we can't say, I don't think it'd be correct to say that we are only what we are perceiving, because we do have these karmic imprints that are always there.
But the neuroplasticity takes care of the karmic aspect of your body.
The neuroplasticity takes care of the karmic aspect. If you're aspiring, say that again. Yeah, I'm not following you there. Inherently existent. It's real, but it's not inherently existent. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 The fact that things are not inherently existent is the reason we can become enlightened. If we were stuck, if we were inherently existent, we couldn't move physically or mentally. We would be stuck. There would be no plasticity of either body or mind. Yeah, because your ultimate nature is empty, is what gives you the possibility of becoming enlightened. The fact that there is no fixed Robbie there is what gives the possibility of enlightenment. Yeah. That's actually what Buddha nature is. The fact that we have no fixed way of being. That's a term that's misunderstood a lot of times. Some people think it means there's a little Buddha in here screaming to get out, and we just have to let him blossom. In the highest tradition, our Buddha nature is the fact that we lack inherent existence, that we are empty sky, and we can fill that sky with whatever we want to, i.e. wisdom and compassion. Okay. No, probably not. No, our Buddha nature is our lack of inherent existence. Really, our emptiness is our Buddha nature, i.e. our potential that we all have, whether we're a cockroach or in the God realm. The fact that we lack inherent existence is what gives us the potential to become enlightened. If we existed independently, inherently, permanently, enlightenment would be an impossibility.
This is one last
question. Yeah.
So that when we are doing breathing meditation,
mm-hmm.
we are in fact going back to the empty sky.
That's
but we don't stop at the empty sky.
Mm-hmm. That's what all the other, yeah. See, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what we do in the more elaborate meditations, where we're meditating on compassion and kindness and other things. That's why we're writing on the blank board, the blank chalkboard that is our Buddha nature, what we want to write on it. We have a choice, okay? Right now, our karma is just forcing us to write on it. We don't like a lot of it, okay? It's not necessarily what we aspire to. Okay. Let's see, I wanted to get through three tonight, and I'm obviously not going to do it. So we're talking about creating karma here, and the main type of karma that we're concerned about in this wheel is created through ignorance is what's referred to as throwing karma. Does anybody know what throwing karma is? Yeah. It's the karma, the strong karma at the time of death that determines your next rebirth. Okay? Okay, so we're talking about throwing karma here. So, that karma may not have been created in that lifetime. That could be a karmic seed that was created in a previous lifetime. So already we're looking at the possibility that we're dealing with more than one life cycle here. I just want to throw that out there. Sometimes the throwing karma is created at the time, during that lifetime.
I thought if you died, let's say, angry and upset, mm-hmm. that was your throwing karma. That was this lifetime, but you're saying it could be something else?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you are angry at the time of death, that is not necessarily what determines your future rebirth, but it may create the cause for negative throwing karma to arise. Okay. At the time of death, yeah. Okay. And again, I am not an expert on this, okay? What karma ripens when is incredibly complicated. As I think I said in the last course, Alex Burson says, the ripening of karma, it looks to us to be, from our limited point of view, to be nonlinear and chaotic. We try and make it into a neat little system, say this, and it doesn't work that way, okay? But that ties in with the fact that this is not just one lifetime, and that there are multiples of these cycles going on in our lifetime right now. We're in different places in this cycle right now, multiple times.
Not in the realm.
Yeah, in the cycle, because you know, you could go through this lifetime and create four or five horrible throwing karmas that will ripen at some point in the future. Okay?
So you could have a nice life and still have a bad throwing karma?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Any more urgent questions? Yeah. We'll have to move faster next week. We'll have to do all 11 next week because then we have to talk about some other things to class afterwards. Okay. Great. Okay, we don't really have time for a meditation. Let's just sit and do a very quick review meditation. I'll just read the 12 links, and you're obviously, I don't think most of you will memorize them tonight, but you may want to think by the end of course of memorizing the 12 links. So we just have a moment, so just a couple deep breaths from the abdomen. Set your motivation. Personal liberation certainly is a wonderful motivation. If you can add to that a little bit of compassion, that's great. We're just going to review the 12 links. They turn as the outer rim of the wheel of life, the hub that keeps that wheel turning is ignorance and subsequent anger and attachment. The 12 links are ignorance, specifically ignorance of self. The ignorance in the center is ignorance of all phenomena and ignorance of karma. second link, karma, formative action, leading to consciousness, leading to name and form, then we have the six sources, and this really represents what we think of as the five senses, and the Tibetans refer to the sixth sense, the mental sense. So this is the ways we interact with our environment, and that's why it's a building with windows. And then from the six sources, we have contact. After contact, feeling arises, basically pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral feelings. Once feelings arise, leads to craving, to have more of it or to push it away. And then even more intensely, it leads to grasping. Grasping leads to becoming, which leads to birth, which inevitably leads to old age and death. Okay. You can relax your concentration. And I have homework from tonight's class. And for those people who weren't here last week, I have last week's homework also. You can pass, those are tonight's. Let's see. Can you give those out to anybody who wants last week's? Who didn't get, let's see. Okay. And remember, we just have 2 more weeks to get through all this. That's a message for myself. Okay. Thank you, everyone. See you all next week. If you have liberation in the palm of your hand, there's a very simple depiction in here of the 12 links. Yes.